Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Bible class here at Hyde Park. We're continuing our long-running series on the Gospel of Mark, getting to know Jesus with our brother James Bargibos. And tonight, in particular, we're looking at He is Risen, because we're up to Mark chapter 16. As an introduction to that, I'll read for you Mark 16, verses 1 to 8.
Well, hello everyone, thanks for coming. Last week, we left Jesus breathing his very last breath of air. At that moment, God turned darkness into light. The centurion says this must have been the Son of God, because all of a sudden the Shekinah glory is shining on Jesus, and it's just so obvious. There's a huge crack from the temple as the veil is torn in half. There is a thunderous earthquake. And while the earth trembled at the horror of Jesus' death, tonight we'll learn that when Jesus rose, the earthquake was a sign of it leaping for joy. So the four Gospels all contain snippets of this story that we'll be dealing with, our final story for this series, the Gospel of Mark. Now, putting it all together, it's not easy. And as our focus is on Mark, I will probably leave some of the harder bits out. But Mark gives us a good little idea from the latter verses of Mark chapter 15 to the end of verse 8 about what was occurring after Jesus had been crucified. So that's the aim. Mark's the topic, and we'll stick to it as best as we can. So we'll remember that it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Jesus is there on the cross. We then read that there was a man who came from the village of Ramah, which I'm pretty sure was Samuel's home base. In Greek, we call it Arimathea. His name was Joseph. And we know a lot of things about him, even from the very brief mention. We know that he was extremely wealthy. He wasn't only on the Sanhedrin, but he was one of the cabinet members. So he was in the top echelon of decision makers. Now, you only got to that stage if you ticked a few boxes. One, you had to have a wife. Two, you had to be an expert in the law. Three, you probably need to buy your way into it. But there was all sorts of other things that we know about Joseph. We're told that he's a good man. We're told that he's just. We suspect that he was a secret disciple. And when he gets to Pilate at the end of Mark chapter 15 and begs the body of Jesus, Pilate can't believe it. He said, well, what are you talking about? It's only like 3 o'clock. He should still be alive. So Pilate calls the centurion that's still just got his head spinning, and he says, yeah, well, Jesus is dead. Okay, Joseph, you want him that bad? That's fine. You can have him. Because as the clock is ticking, remember that it's both the Passover and the Sabbath day. So this is the day before the Sabbath. Okay, so we're dealing with Friday night. So once the green light is given, Joseph then has to quickly go to the shops. He has to get there before sunset, because that's when the shops all shut because of Sabbath and Passover. So it was one of these unusual one-in-seven-year events. Anyway, when he gets there, he goes and buys a bolt of linen. But he's not the only person that's running off to the shops. Nicodemus is also helping Joseph in the interment of Jesus' body. He then goes off to a separate merchant and buys a whopping large amount of myrrh and aloes. If we check with Psalm 45 and Exodus chapter 30, yep, these products are fit ingredients for the burial of a king. So let's think about this too.
Let's think about this really carefully. Jesus had to be pulled down from the cross. So I think it's unlikely that Joseph and Nicodemus would have done this by themselves. It wasn't a long distance for that beaten and crumpled body to be taken to Joseph's own burial plot. Hewn out of rock, it was only just completed. There had never been a dead body in that before. Now, if it was just Joseph and Nicodemus that were following the normal burial process of gently removing the blood, the gore, cleaning and gently caring for Jesus, tearing up the strips, moistening those strips with either water or alcohol or a combination of both, or perhaps they were dried herbs, their work would have been thorough and thoughtful and also really time-consuming. They didn't share a Passover meal with their families that night either, because they would have been working on Jesus' body well into the night. It was Joseph's tomb, as I mentioned, a brand new tomb. Isaiah 53 verse 9 probably makes reference to the rich man. That's probably Joseph of Arimathea. The stone is rolled over the tomb and the tomb is sealed. So when Jesus awoke, all he saw was the angels, possibly the seamless coat that his mother had made for him, that Joseph probably bought for beer money from the soldiers that were about to tear it to shreds. But the important thing that Jesus didn't see in this tomb, because it was new, was corruption. Thou wilt not suffer thy Holy One to see corruption. So that's quite layered, isn't it? It wasn't just that Jesus wouldn't die, wouldn't deteriorate physically, but he wouldn't be surrounded by corruption either. But there were other eyes watching. So we know that both Mary Magdalene and Mary, the wife of Alphaeus, the brother of Joseph, Jesus' stepfather, watched until the very last minute when that huge stone was finally rolled into place. That would also imply that the two Marys missed out on the Passover lamb. But it should be no surprise as to who Jesus saw first when he arose from the tomb. So let's just try to get a little bit of sort of perspective on timing. Because of the prophecy in Matthew 12 where the Pharisees wanted a sign and Jesus said, well, I'll give you a sign. It'll be the sign of the prophet Jonah, that he was buried in the fish for 3 days and three nights. Now, we have to manufacture some things if we want Jesus to physically be in the grave for 72 hours. The first thing that we have to manufacture is this. If Jesus passes away at 3 o'clock and he doesn't see Mary until 8 or 9 a.m., on the day after the Sabbath, what was Jesus doing for those 12 hours and why hadn't he yet ascended to his Father, John 20 verse 17? So the other challenge that we need to think about is Jewish time operates on a different scale hours, because their day starts and finishes at sunset or approximately 6 p.m. So I don't want to get into a big thing about it, but to me, Jesus dies at 3 o'clock on the Friday. His body is buried on the first evening. So the first day is actually starting from 3 o'clock. we are also aware that the Pharisees then go and say to Pilate, hey, look, you know what he said? He said he was going to be resurrected on the third day. So we need to make sure that you guys protect the body so no one can break in and steal him. And Pilate said, well, you sort it out yourself. You got guards, you can deal with that. I think it's unlikely that that meeting of the Sanhedrin occurred after 6 o'clock. So see up here, we've got, oh, this doesn't work, does it? So see up here, 15 this end, we've got the two started. Probably unlikely. Probably, I think it happened after the Sabbath had finished. Now, some other things happen. So 16 Nisan at the night are given. So I don't think that Jesus was really saying that I have to clinically be entombed for 72 hours. In fact, if we have a look at various episodes where days are described, Genesis 42, verse 17 to 18, for example, 2 Chronicles 10, verse 5, Esther 4, verse 6, a third day can be quite vague. But if it's on the third day, to me, it's probably less than 72 hours. But don't you think the point of the sign that Jesus gave was the fact that he would be put to death, he would be buried, and he would be raised to life? That's the sign. The actual time frame, I think, is secondary to that. So we need not be concerned about the exact time that Jesus was in the tomb, because what's that got to do with our salvation? What has everything to do with our salvation is Jesus died and Jesus was buried, and most critically, he rose. And as we'll see, that is something that the apostles find really important too. So if we just have a look at the language that not only Mark records, so that's quite specific, and Paul records, if we compare Abraham, when he was offering Isaac in Genesis 22, it was also on the third day. So to me, the evidence is pretty comprehensive. So Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joses, beheld where he was laid. Now, harmonising the gospel records is not easy, as I've said. And it's mainly because we're trying to identify when the Sabbath was over. So to a Jew, that means at 6 p.m. So what happens after 6 p.m? There is an initial visit. The shops are open. And so more material is bought to care tenderly for the body of Jesus. I think that this is a bit unusual because Jesus was already buried, but it was a common practice that on the third day a tomb would be opened and that body would be cared for. So clearly, if the women that we read about in Mark chapter 16 were there before sun had arisen, it's unlikely that there'll be any position to go and buy anything. But it looks like they had done that the night before. So as I mentioned, there were guards appointed. Brave fellows, they had a pretty tough job. All they had to do was to make sure, they had just one job, make sure that no one rolls a stone away. And there's another earthquake. Accompanying the earthquake was an angel. And if we read it, what happens carefully, it says that their fear overtook them and their hearts became as stone. So it was like these guards just, they've seen the angel, they've heard the noise, and they've felt it. And they were paralysed with fright. How do we actually know that? So how do we know that the angels were, that the guards were so scared that they were sort of Their hearts were skipping a beat. Who's watching? Well, for all intents and purposes, the only people there are the guards and the angel. So this is before the women arrive. Afterwards, the angel goes into the tomb, has rolled away the stone, holds Jesus' hand, and brings him back to life, accompanied by another angel. Now, the second angel, I think, took some time because for some weird reason, after the stone's rolled away, the first angel is just sitting there on top of the stone. It disappeared like he was waiting for the other angel to arrive. The earthquake occurs on Sunday morning, the first day of the week. How do we know these guards were scared? Jesus prayed on the cross for God to forgive them their sins. My argument was, well, whose sins were they? Whose sins need to be forgiven? And did God answer that prayer? As if God wouldn't answer some of the final words of Jesus in prayer about the forgiveness of sins. My argument was, he was talking directly to the soldiers. It says that some of the soldiers took bribes to hush, keep this quiet, because they didn't want it to be known that, they'd fallen asleep on the job. But the key word, some, right? I think others of that soldiers, that guard, actually became Christian. They followed Jesus. Jesus' prayer was answered, because to have forgiveness of sins requires belief, it requires baptism, it requires a life, it requires an expectation. So the only way that prayer could ultimately be fulfilled is if some of them actually followed the Lord Jesus Christ. So Jesus is resurrected very early on the Sunday morning. Let's just say between 4 and 5 a.m. What was the women's plan? Well, as I mentioned, we are told that they were going to tend for Jesus. They were going to care for his body, but they had a problem. On the way, they've realised that it's just them, and who's going to roll the stone away? Is it going to be the soldiers? More than likely, they knew the soldiers were there because, remember, this small group of women were there the night before. It would appear from Luke that added to this group on the morning of Sunday was Joanna and Susanna. We get that from Luke chapter 24. But I think we can have a little bit of sympathy for this lack of forethought, this technical administrative matter of trying to get into the tomb, because they'd been backwards and forwards several times. Mary and the other Mary had stayed back respectfully as Jesus was being cared for. They'd bought the spices. They were in mourning. They hadn't slept. But there was one thing that they were determined to do. They were determined to serve the Lord in his death like they had in his life. These women are special women. We first meet them up in Galilee, where specifically we're told that they did what they could to provide for Jesus. That didn't simply mean that they were on the catering committee. It meant that they opened their wallets and purses and funded him and the disciples on that 3.5 years of Jesus trying to convert the people. And we will see a little bit later on that there is one woman in particular who is really the focus of this entire narrative, especially in John's Gospel. Now, if the soldiers wouldn't do it for them, who else would there be? Well, remember, it's Joseph's tomb. He probably had servants that would had helped him previously with Jesus' body. Maybe they would be there, but it's pretty early because Mary gets up and it's not even daylight. And at this stage, when they're getting towards the tomb, it is still grey light. Critically, when they get to the point where they see the sepulchre, it says, and they look up. So there's enough light for them to see, somewhat horrified, that someone had got there first and already opened the sepulchre. And they assumed the worst. So what happens from here? As soon as Mary sees that stone had been rolled away and the tomb was open, she runs back into town and she finds Peter and she finds John. She knocks on the door and she says, look, you've got to come to the tomb. They've taken Jesus away and I don't know where they've laid him. Wiping the sleep and the tears out of their eyes, they both get up and start running towards the tomb. Just park that for a moment. The others, in the meantime, climb the slope, peek inside, go in and query the angel. What is the first thing that generally angels say to anyone? Don't fear. Don't be frightened. Jesus is risen. Remember, that's what he said he would, that's what he said would happen to him. He is risen. Come in and see. And so they go in and see. Let's go back to Mary. All Mary Magdalene wants to do is to look after her Lord. She wants help. So with tears, tripping, confused, she runs to get these two important aids of the Lord. These other women have squeezed now into the tomb. They can't see a body, but they see the angel, and eventually they see a second angel. Now, when they're told not to fear, I'm sure that they would have asked questions like, who are you? What are you doing here? Where is Jesus? Because it seems like the angels are responding to a series of questions, whether they were out loud or at least in their mind. I know you're looking for Jesus, is what the angels are saying. I know you're looking for Jesus. Do you know an angel's going to come to each one of us one day and say, I know you're looking for Jesus. So, I can imagine my angel saying to me, poor angel with an unenviable task of looking after someone like me, saying something similar, you know, hey, tough guy, don't be scared. Jesus is here. Everything's going to be okay. It's time. Christ is returning. It's all set in motion. I know you're looking for Jesus, our angels will say to us, just like this angel said to these women. Mary, the wife of Alphaeus, knows exactly where the Lord's been laid. She watched it all happen. But at this point, she was told, this is where the Lord lay, that cold, lifeless body. Was Jesus. That body didn't travel anywhere. That spirit didn't go anywhere. This is where Jesus lay. We also need to think about this. Not one of the gospel writers tries to define or describe what happened with the resurrection. There is no even close conversation about what has gone on in that tomb. It's all left up to our vivid imaginations. Now, this is, to me, quite interesting. There are pairs. There's these sort of binary aspects of this story. So let's just think about a few of them. So Mark names the two devout women, the two Marys. Jesus is interred by two of his disciples. There are two earthquakes. There are two angels. Joseph's sepulchre was in a garden. So there are two gardens. There are two malefactors on the cross. And perhaps the fact that this is a second garden might help to explain why Jesus had spent hours in that place before he went to see his father. What are we being told here? Well, remember the story of the kangaroo court, where all of these false witnesses were trying to stand up and say what Jesus had done or what Jesus hadn't done, and their stories they weren't holding water, they were holding no weight. And it was because they couldn't agree. And so under the law, that's why you had to have two or three witnesses if there was a death penalty, because the story had to be corroborated, it had to be consistent. Well, there were two witnesses at Jesus' trial. More than likely, there was Joseph of Arimathea, who sat on the board of the Sanhedrin. Who did he report to? Well, Nicodemus in John 3 is described as a teacher. No. The teacher. The teacher. He was the chairman of that board. So perhaps their skillful navigation of the law ensured that Jesus' false witnesses weren't given the easy free ride. So with the occasional interpolation, a word, a cough, a gesture, or an objection, Your Honour, from these experts, maybe that was enough to demonstrate the contradictory nature and the insufficiency of all of the evidence. But in doing that, they couldn't be secret disciples any longer. There was no secrecy anymore when Joseph goes into the house of Pilate and begs the body of Jesus. He did that openly in front of the servants, so word was out. It was no longer necessary to meet Jesus by night. They could now do it in broad daylight. Meanwhile, back at the tomb, remember Mary Magdalene? She's gone running off into town to get James and John. She is not in the tomb with the other women when the angels then said to her, like we read tonight, you need to go and tell Peter that Jesus will see him in Galilee. Now we know that at the end of the day, Jesus actually saw all of his disciples. It says that they were scared. They were afraid because the body wasn't there. They didn't really believe either the women or Mary Magdalene's story, even afterwards. So Jesus then goes and says, it's me. Who wasn't there? I'll believe it was Jesus when I physically touch him, when I can physically put my hands on his hands and into his side. That's the evidence that Thomas required. No one needed Jesus to be resurrected more than Peter. None had been as vocal in proclaiming their loyalty to Jesus, nor had fallen to such depths in his denial, where he was fierce, crude, and violent, blasphemous, where he really completely and utterly disowned Jesus, who he really loved as his own soul. And so it's no wonder that he was weeping then and probably now. aside from the women, I don't think many had suffered as miserably over the weekend as Peter. Well, they got there as fast as their legs could take them. They leave at the same time. John arrives first. He doesn't go in though, he stands there. Younger perhaps, fitter. Then Peter arrives and cautiously bolts straight into the tomb. So their heads are swimming. No one said anything to anyone by this stage. All they'd been doing is running. And then they're amazed. And they're stunned with joy. Relayed in part in John's Gospel, where this is covered off in quite a bit more detail than the others. It says about John that he believed. It doesn't say that yet about Peter. But in about 8 days' time, there's no doubt about it. They go in and they see a napkin where Jesus' head was. They see stripes, bandages torn into strips, linen cloth, possibly Jesus' coat, all sort of there in a neat pile if he wasn't wearing it. What does it imply? What do those neat pile of garments imply? Let's say I'm a grave robber. Am I going to go to the effort of slowly taking those strips off the person before I steal his body? A process which had taken hours to do. Now, admittedly, if dried spices were used, that task wouldn't be as difficult. But do you know, if the bandages are wet with those spices, with either water or alcohol, after a couple of days, they actually take the form, the shape of the body. So that probably didn't happen, right? But either way, this body wasn't stolen. This body was resurrected. Now we're going to step away from Mark, because pretty much all that we've got about this resurrection story from Mark is finished. And we have to go over to John to get this perspective. This means that Mary and John have a pretty intimate and deep conversation about what had happened. Because John, remember, at the end of his gospel says, look, I've seen this, I've witnessed this with my own eyes. Well, he couldn't have seen this because he wasn't there. So someone had to tell him. See, what had happened is the guards arrive. The guards have a heart attack. The angels arrive. The guards run away. The group of women arrive. Mary Magdalene runs off. The other women go into the tomb. Peter and John arrive. They then leave. But Mary is still there. With her heart pounding, she ran back to the tomb. Of course she did. Now, because men are men, they went up to Mary and they gave her a consoling hug and told her everything was going to be okay. Now, pretty typically, they just saw her in tears and just walked back, completely inconsiderate of this poor lady. Now, even though it's still a little later in the morning, it's still very early in the morning. The sun is still sort of coming up in the eastern sky. Well, she's completely alone and she's bewildered. But somehow she finds the bravery to go up to the tomb. And unlike the first time she visited, that Friday evening, this time, she creeps in, she stoops down, and enters Jesus' resting place. She is so acutely grief-stricken, she doesn't even recognize the angels. There's no "fear not, Mary." So these angels who caused the hearts of the guards to stop, the hearts of the women to skip a beat, couldn't distract her at all. She is so single-minded about wanting to know where Jesus is. "Why are you weeping, Mary?" Mary's cause for weeping and ours will be so much more acute if she saw Jesus lying there. Think about that. Why does Mary stay? Why would we stay? She was there last night, and she was there again early this morning because she wanted to lavish all of her devotion on this crucified body. If only her love and her deep loss could express themselves in just one final act of service. Just who is this Mary? Well, Mary would have got on quite well with most of the disciples. She comes from a fishing village on the west side of Galilee. You can see that it's not very far from Cana, not very far from Capernaum. It's possible that, see where it's got Dalmanutha and Magadan? It's possible that Dalmanutha actually is the same place, just in Greek. But anyway, this is where it was. And according to the Babylonian Talmud, the name Magdala means the tower of the fishes. So, Kyrios, you would have loved this place. So this was literally the place where they would process the fish. Josephus references it, just as an aside. So growing up in this fishing town, surrounded by fishermen, yep, she would have been right at home with these roughnecks, Peter, Andrew, James, John, and possibly some others. So Luke 8 is when we're first introduced to her. And certain women which had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, these are the women. There was Mary, called Magdalene, out of whom went seven devils. Now, that's quite a few devils. It's not six, it's not eight. And there's Joanna, the wife of Chaza, Herod's steward, Susanna, and many others who use their considerable means to provide for the company. What was Mary's occupation? We know she wasn't a fisherwoman. What was her job? Don't be shy. Have a stab. Try to clean it up as best you can. She was an harlot. Yeah, so if you look up Mary, she's the patron saint of penitent prostitutes. Now, this idea about Mary began in a sermon by Pope Gregory in 591, where he identified Mary as Mary of Bethany and the sinful woman that was at Jesus' feet. This identification, however, about 1,400 years later, was edited by the Pope, whose name just escapes me. What it highlights, though, is mud sticks, because that's what she was labelled and that's what she was called for 1,400 years. And so it's, I guess, stuck into our memories too. It is most likely that she was a very intelligent woman. She was a woman that had great respect, so much so that her friends were sort of the royal prime ministers in her household, and they could freely associate with her. And while it says that Mary was from Magdala, we don't know whether that's where she was born or that was in fact her hometown. Do you know she's mentioned by name 12 times in the Gospels, which is more than most of the apostles, more than any other woman in the Gospels, even Jesus' own family. All right, we'll just do a quick little survey on the age of Mary. So Jesus, 33. Let's go. Was Mary 30 and under, 30 to 50, 50 and over? Okay, so there's our three choices. Hands up, under 30. Who thinks Mary was under 30? Young? Okay. 30 to 50? All right, chose B. Over 50. Joshy, over 50. I'm sorry, that wasn't part of this poll. Catherine. There's always one, every time. It's normally me, but tonight it was Catherine. Josh, I reckon you're right. The only reason, possibly, that we could think Mary was young when we're not told anything about her is because of the movies, like most things. So, you know, you see a picture of that woman and we go, oh, yeah, well, yeah, she must have been about 30 years old. So let's think about who her peers and contemporaries are.
Do you think a harlot would have a lot of success being older woman?
Pardon? I reckon if I answer that question, I could make myself culpable. So,
I think people, it's not so much the movies, I think people just assume it's the younger person because of her occupation.
Yeah, well, remember, she wasn't a prostitute. That's false.
Yeah, but that's what Karen's saying. Because people have that association.
Oh, so that's the link. That's causal. Yeah. Don't know.
But she found it that old because she ran with the disciples. She ran.
Have you ever been chased by Lainey around the kitchen? Don't worry. Don't worry.
Yeah, but there's a difference between a kitchen and Jerusalem.
So let's think about her peers. Now, I know that this isn't conclusive, right? Because even in Jesus' disciple group, there was James, whose son was in the disciples, right? So he was obviously older than Jesus. But she's there with Mary, the wife of Alphaeus. So it goes Jude, James, Alphaeus. Okay? So this woman, Mary, the wife of Alphaeus, mother of James and Joses, is a grandma. Okay? She's at the foot of the cross with Mary, the Lord's mother, 50s. And Salome, Mary's sister, Mary, the Lord's mother's sister, the wife of Zebedee. Again, because they're sisters, they've got to be close in age, I think. So it's not conclusive, but to me, her peers might tell a bit of a story too. She may well, like some of these other women, Alphaeus probably passed away, Joseph, his brother probably passed away, may have lost her husband, and perhaps that had given her the capacity financially to support the Lord and also the time to assist the Lord Jesus Christ. Bit of a spoiler alert now, she's just about to come face to face with Jesus. But after this, we never hear anything about Mary Magdalene again. Again, it might indicate her age. One thing which I do want to share, and I think this is pretty powerful, one writer described Mary Magdalene as this: the apostle to the apostles. No surprise, because she's mentioned more than most of them. She was the most understated, amazing of all of the apostles. The sepulchre is on high ground. Okay, remember, because the women look up. So why is it? You'll have a look at... What does your version say, Jim?
This is when they looked, they saw
that... Oh, have a look at most ESV. What does that say? Looking up, yeah. So it's a funny Greek thing where it's directional. So the reason why that is important to me, the up bit, is because they've come somewhere, and I want to try to understand why Mary can't recognize Jesus. So firstly, she assumes that Jesus is the gardener. Let's fill in some gaps, hey? Let's have a look at John chapter 20. Ooh, sorry, and we're getting long in the tooth here. So, verse 17 is the key one. So she's, verse 14, she's had a conversation with the angels. She's not scared of the angels. She doesn't even recognize them. She just wants to know where Jesus is. I don't know where they've laid him. So verse 14, she turns around and she didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus says to her, "Woman, why weepest thou? Who are you seeking?" 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words. For those of us that used to use telephones, remember when someone would phone us without their name on the screen, we'd know who that person was. Mary knew Jesus' voice. She thought he was the gardener. Now, I don't think gardeners get up this early. I suspect that's not the term gardener, but the person that owned the garden, because she calls him sir. Wrong. The word is Lord. Lord, if you know where Jesus is, tell me where you've laid him and I will take him away. It might have taken 4 men to deal with Jesus to get him off the cross, but Mary says, I will do it. Show me where he is. Okay. It's early in the morning. The sun's rising. Jesus is in the east. Mary has been sobbing for 2 years. Everything's swollen. For 2 days. Everything's swollen. She's had no sleep. She'd just been running, and she sort of sees this smudge, and she just assumes it's the gardener because he's come out of the garden. Gardener, Adam's first job. Second Adam is to be the principal of a new garden. As the owner, you might have chosen to relocate Jesus. So she's tired, she's teetering on exhaustion, and she says, "You show me where he is, and single-handedly I'll go and care for him." She says this almost to herself, right? Because then she starts to wander away. So Jesus has to say to her, "Mary." And how blind she'd been not to recognize him. All of the emotions and these endorphins drop kick the tears and the grief away. "Teacher," she says, and she launches herself at him and she does not let go. "Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." That touching is like repeatedly, like the best way to describe it is, "Mary, you're clinging on to me. I've got to go. I really have to go." So this is a pretty sweet and special moment for Jesus, who chose to identify himself first with this truly amazing and loyal friend. And for Mary, perhaps still a blubbering mess, maybe she's no longer a mess. I'm really curious as to why Jesus was in the garden and how long he'd been there. We're given a clue in Isaiah 53. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. The NET says, after he awakes, after he has suffered, he will reflect on it. He will reflect on his work. When did Jesus have time to reflect on his work? Where? We know where, because he went to the Garden of Gethsemane quite regularly. I think Jesus has just sat in the garden, he's chewed it all over, he's weighed it all up, and he's then had to think about the big picture. I don't believe Jesus had to go to God to receive eternal life. Jesus was raised mortal, because that's the process. We know that from the chapter of resurrection. Sophie, which is where? Come on. Josh, you can help her. 20 push-ups for both of you. I'll give you a clue. 1 Corinthians. 15. So it's one of the things I really try my hardest to have kids learn. It's where these chapters are. Chapter of resurrection is 1 Corinthians 15. Jesus wasn't raised immortal. When the resurrected are raised, they're not raised immortal. They're raised to be judged. Mary, I haven't seen Dad. Don't hang on to me, Mary, because now's my time. I want to go and see my dad. The big story of Mark's gospel is that Jesus is risen. It is not Jesus' death. Jesus' death was the means by which God could raise him, because he lived a life that justified that, because the grave couldn't hold him, right? Jesus' death is the means by which God is reconciled to the world, because that sacrifice had to hang up there on a stake and bleed out and die. But without the resurrection, there's no truth, there's no faith, there's no hope, there's no gospel, there's no life here, there's no life hereafter. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, everything we've told you is smoke and mirrors. We would be guilty of telling a whole series of barefaced lies if Jesus wasn't resurrected. The emphasis of the apostles' teaching over and over is that Jesus is alive. He is living. Put simply in 2 Timothy 2, verse 8, Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. Paul didn't need to be convinced that Jesus existed. That neither did the disciples. They all saw him and they ate with him before and after he had died. But they had to eat with him. Jesus ate. Because it needed to be affirmed that he wasn't a ghost or a figment of their imagination, but a physical being, albeit with the amazing power of eternity, which included to disappear at will, as we're told. So try telling John or Peter or the guards or Joseph or Mary they didn't really see Jesus. Jesus then asked the disciples to touch his hand and his side. Mary hugged him, and in Matthew 28 we're told that they hung onto his feet. Our Redeemer lives, and the linchpin of our hope, our foundation, the reason why we keep on believing, it's because of the resurrection, and he is living. The Gospel of Mark. So Mark has no account of the virgin birth, or for that matter, the birth of Jesus at all. He doesn't even mention Joseph, Jesus' father. Jesus is called the son of Mary. But even more significant is Mark's strange ending. There's no appearance of Jesus following the visit to the woman at the empty tomb. Is it curious to you that Mark was the shortest gospel and the first gospel written, yet it's not the first gospel in the Bible? Why? Like, if it was the first one written, surely you'd put it first. Well, apparently the Gospel of Mark was deemed to be insufficient. As if. It is a powerful recollection of the reason for us being servants of Christ. The Gospel of Mark is our hope. It's an inspiration. And the last thing I'll leave you about the Gospel of Mark is. Well, Jesus' last words were pretty important that Mark records. Believe, be baptized, be saved. Be saved from sin immediately, but saved from death if judged eternally. Jesus' last words. Well, that would be true if we believe the last 11 verses are actually in the original text. But that, brothers and sisters, is a story for another time.